Hello, I'm Stephen Brook, and this is Media Talk. Coming up, putting the duck into the Evening Standard. We'll discuss the implications for the British press as Russian billionaire Alexander Lebedev is poised to become Fleet Street's newest proprietor. Also in the podcast, it's decision time for PSB. We'll talk about the final push by the BBC, ITV and Channel 4 to shape the future of broadcasting. Plus...
Good morning, it's 9 o'clock. This is The Breakfast Phone-In on 5 Live. I'm Nicky Campbell. Between now and 10...
Nicky Campbell returns to phone-in action. We'll assess the revamped morning lineup at 5 Live. And...
Mr. Wells is going to attempt to deliver a set of deliberate night attack orders in 30 seconds.
Mr. Wells, come on.
You've read the story, now watch the video. We'll talk about the news of the world, Prince Harry, and the evolution of the tabloid front page splash. It's all coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, your regular host Matt Wells is somewhere off-piste this week, so I'm delighted to say that I'll be your charming host for the next half hour. My panel is made up this week of two media talkers who've just had their first tour around The Guardian's new King's Place offices. Maggie Brown is a Media Guardian columnist and Channel 4 historian. Was the decor to your liking, Maggie?
Oh, I think I'd love to live here. I think I'm moving in.
Also here in the studio is broadcasting consultant and managing director of KidsCo TV, Paul Robinson. Now, have you had some prep time in one of our special Guardian Think Out pods?
No, I haven't, but I think the studio is fantastic. I'm taking the headphones with me. But I do approve of the entrance to the building where you have the condoms for the umbrellas, where you put your wet umbrella in, pull it out, and the plastic covers it so no dripping everywhere. They are fantastic, and it's the first place I've seen them in London.
Excellent. Well, team, if you're all sitting comfortably, let's put on our Cossack hats and get things going.
Media Talk from Guardian.co.uk.
Well, it's probably one of the biggest stories to hit the British newspaper industry for decades. No, it's not The Guardian's front page campaign against Aga Ovens, but it's the news that the London Evening Standard is being bought by a Russian oligarch, Alexander Lebedev. And it means that the former KGB spy is Fleet Street's newest and, sorry Richard Desmond, most controversial proprietor. But just who is he exactly, and what will he bring to the Standard? We spoke to The Guardian's Moscow correspondent Luke Harding to find out more.
Well, he's rather charming and rather low-key. He speaks really rather exquisite English for a Russian with a slightly kind of American accent. He's sort of rather fashionably dressed. He wears sort of suits, but he also wears sneakers. He doesn't really kind of look like your kind of typical oligarch, I have to say. And in terms of why he's buying the Standard, I think he realizes that essentially he can't do more than what he's already done inside Russia. He's not exactly a kind of critic of Vladimir Putin, but neither is he a friend. He's a sort of quasi-opposition figure here. He's the owner of Novaya Gazeta, which is this sort of small oppositionist newspaper in Moscow, which is one of the very few newspapers left here that actually criticizes the government. And his attempts to kind of set up other bigger, more successful newspapers here have sort of failed. Basically, he's been squeezed out by the Kremlin, or other people, friends of the Kremlin, have come in and bought titles that he's been interested in. So, in a sense, Britain, which I think is a place he feels very much at home, is a logical choice for him.
This guy is a former KGB spy. He must have charmed all and sundry if he's got the Rothermere's to sell the Standard to him, and B, the British government to agree to the deal.
That's right. I mean, that's an interesting point. He did work for the KGB. He was a kind of lieutenant colonel in the late 1980s, based at the Soviet embassy in Kensington Palace Gardens up until 1992, when the Soviet Union collapsed. It disappeared formally. And his job at the time was to, you know, read the British newspapers every morning, including the Standard. Now, since then, of course, he came out to Moscow. He bought a private bank, rather an unsuccessful one in the mid-90s, and transformed it into a very successful bank, and then acquired other interests, including a big share in Aeroflot, the state airline. And by last year was worth, according to his reckoning, some $3.5 billion. He wouldn't say a huge amount about his negotiations with Lord Rothermere, but it's clear that they're friends. He talks about Jonathan and Claudia, And that's Mrs. Rothermere, who he says he's known for some time. Very friendly terms via the Ryza Gorbachev Foundation, which is this cancer charity he runs. The thing about Lebedev is that, as he says himself, he's got friends of all echelons of society, which I think is a polite way of saying that he knows some very important and influential people in Britain. I mean, a lot of them are artistic people. He knows Tom Stoppard. He knows Kevin Spacey. He recently bought a sculpture from Anthony Gormley and hung out with him. So he knows people on the creative side, but he also knows kind of, you know, old-fashioned aristocrats and showbiz people too. His son Yevgeny is close to a lot of people. He knows Elton John. He knows Hugh Grant a bit, and so I think this gives him an entree into British society and possibly makes him more acceptable to Lord Rothermere as someone who will nurture and, you know, possibly even bring on the Evening Standard.
We know that he's extremely well connected. We also know that he's worth, despite the economic downturn, about £2 billion. I was struck by something he told you, was that he thought that the Evening Standard was quite a good way to lose money. So it sounds like he's going to be a bit of a benevolent proprietor.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's how he's positioning himself. I think he's under no illusions that the Evening Standard can be sort of swiftly and miraculously transformed into a kind of newspaper that makes a lot of money. I think he realizes that the Evening Standard is loss-making. As an investor, as an owner, he's going to be in it for the long haul. He was talking about years. So it seems to me that he's not simply going to bin the Evening Standard after 12 months if it fails to reach a profit. He's going to try and work it out. Having said that, he was vague on details. As far as I can see, he's got no idea who the new editor of the Evening Standard will be. I think that there will definitely be a new editor. Some of his sort of plans for the paper, some of the themes he thought that the paper should be interested in, like he mentioned Sudan and Darfur and corruption and things like that. While these are kind of very noble themes, they struck me as being, you know, somewhat naive. I think the key point is that he will be a hands-off proprietor, and if he can assemble a decent creative editorial team, there's no reason why the Standard can't, in the end, be a successful product.
Well, Luke Harding there. And it seems that Lebedev is someone who wears suits, but he also likes to wear sneakers with his suits. He knows Tom Stoppard on a social level, and when asked about what he would like to see in the Evening Standard, he talked about Darfur and the Sudan. Maggie, do you think he'll be a good thing or a bad thing for the Standard?
I'm instinctively really worried. When I saw this story, when it first broke, I thought, that can't be allowed to happen. That isn't real, is it? But if our stories are correct, and there's every reason to suppose they are, it is happening, and I find myself thinking that this is a great newspaper, the great surviving newspaper, one of 14. I myself reported on the merger of the Evening News and Standard back in 1980. One's seen this whittling down of support for the paper, but nonetheless, it's hugely influential. And I somehow still, in my bones, don't think that a newspaper like this, a quasi-national newspaper, is like a football club. It has a real role in democracy, in many ways setting the agenda from Parliament and for the national newspapers the next morning. So I'm really concerned.
Paul, are you still a fan of the Standard, or have you moved on to London Light and the London paper?
I must admit, really, I've stopped reading the Standard unless I get a free copy. You know, I read Metro in the morning. I read City AM sometimes, just very quickly. I've been doing so recently, obviously. You know, London paper, London Light in the evening. I very rarely see the Standard. And actually, you know, I think there's too much fuss being made about this. At the end of the day, the question is, will he as the owner interfere with editorial process? And I think that's the question here. I mean, if he does not, what's the issue? What we have is a situation where, you know, Russia as an economy is becoming increasingly influential, and Russian oligarchs or Russian businesses are going to be increasingly able to buy Western businesses. That's the way the world's going, so grow up.
Well, what we do know at this stage on the issue of editorial interference is that there will be a new editor. Veronica Wadley will be moved on, perhaps back into Associated. Geordie Grieg from Tatler is looking like the man who's going to be approached to take the top job at the Standard. Also, Lebedev has talked about starting up this editorial board that will see luminaries such as Tony Blair appointed, presumably to hopefully satisfy people such as yourself, Maggie, that this will be an okay arrangement, because there'll be some distance between him and getting his hands on the Standard editorials. Will that be enough to satisfy you?
Why does he want it? I mean, if he's not going to intervene, well, I mean, I'm a KGB spy in that case. I think it is a really fantastic newspaper. I think it's been in an appallingly difficult situation. It's a sophisticated paper. It's I agree, an upmarket paper. It doesn't meet all the needs of Londoners. There are many question marks against it. I know Veronica Wadley is seen as too right-wing. They're also, you know, represents almost like the Hampstead well-off class, but nonetheless, I find it a vigorous paper. I have a friend in particular who was pursued by the Standard, and it can be, when it gets its teeth into people, it can be quite a vicious paper too. But nonetheless, it comes with a life and an agenda of its own. I am really sorry about this.
Well, we've got some feedback from the blogs. Tonka Tom seems to agree with you, Maggie, and he's been asking, is he the only one who thinks that ex-KGB agents should not be allowed to buy major UK newspapers? We've also heard that Paul Dacre is so annoyed with this whole transaction that he's actually deliberately taken himself off to the Caribbean for a fortnight's holiday.
He should be there fighting his corner.
I think the implication is that he did fight and lost, and Lord Rothermere decided to do this over and above his objections.
But this is all to do with money, isn't it, Stephen? I mean, the Standard is losing a packet, what, between 10 and 20 million pounds a year?
Well, one source said to us that if you separate all the accounts out and the benefits it gets from being part of the group, it's 25 million.
That's a lot, isn't it?
A year.
And so, of course, they pumped in all this money on the free sheets, basically. They're trying to preserve their London advertising base, I think, but in a different way.
Yeah.
If the reality is that in the regional newspaper market, we're moving towards a different business model, which is actually not paid for, free, advertising-based product. Frankly, if that's the way the world's going, they're pushing water uphill. And, you know, you're not going to change that. So I think you've just got to, you know, accept maybe that's the way regional papers are going.
Maggie, do you agree?
I don't. But I do think we're in the most appalling situation where advertising is declining anyway, maybe 20% this year.
Yeah, but that's a current situation.
You're really see a parting of the ways where quality papers are pushing up their prices and holding on to a subscription element, and everybody else is just having to do cheap and cheerful quick read-offs. I mean, at least the Standard manages to investigate and manages to have some verve to its writing.
I'm Stephen Brook, and for Guardian Business subs who might be listening, that's with a PH, not a V. Still to come on Media Talk, we'll discuss if Ofcom wants a merger of Channel 4 and 5. And TV's Gareth McLean will join us to talk Countdown, Unforgiven, Minder, and Chop Idol. But before all that, let's round up a few of the other media stories from last week. Now, Paul, you're a former radio executive, so let's start with you. And the Radio 2 controller. Interviews have been running. Word is Matthew Bannister's in the race. Have they been tapping you on the shoulder by any chance?
I have not gone for that job, but the Matthew Bannister story is very interesting. And I guess Matthew being interviewed will send a chill wind through a number of DJs who are now at Radio 2, who were at Radio 1 when Matthew repositioned Radio 1. So, you know, it's a very interesting choice if Matthew indeed is a serious contender. I mean, I guess, you know, given the structure of the BBC radio management now with the top guy, you know, coming from marketing, having a very strong controller who's got a track record and a very strong editorial point of view makes sense for Radio 2. And frankly, Leslie Douglas is, you know, quite a tough act to follow. So Matthew makes sense, but it'd be a very strange move for him as well as for the BBC were he to get the job. But I don't think it's crazy.
Well, they definitely need a strong editorial person at the top. We've seen that with the Russell Brand fiasco, don't we? But do they need someone who will reposition Radio 2? Because everyone seems to be saying it's doing just fine as it is.
Well, the BBC will say that. The commercial sector will say, actually, the problem with Radio 2 is it's like a black hole. It sucks in audience from commercial radio. And once audiences are there, they never come out again and commercial radio can't get them back. And the problem is actually Radio 2, if anything, having gone younger initially with Steve Wright and Jonathan Ross, has gone so young now, it's really damaging commercial radio. And at times, you can listen to Radio 2 and see and hear a more edgy record on Radio 2 than you can on Radio 1. So, you know, for Radio 2, it's more about getting back to its public service purpose and focusing on its target audience and not trying to serve literally everybody.
So if it's not Matthew, who do you think it's going to be? And not you, of course.
It's not me. My money is still on Andy Parfit.
Yes.
And I say that because Andy is a good BBC servant. He understands public service broadcasting. I've said this before. And he clearly can't continue to run Radio 1 at the age of 50.
Exactly. But he's just been made head of all singing or all dancing music.
He can still do Radio. He can still do Radio 2.
But that was the problem with Leslie Douglas, that she was doing too many jobs. She wasn't actually running Radio 2. She was doing the music as well. And that distracted her.
No, I don't think so. I think Leslie Douglas made a fundamental mistake. And that was to agree, looking on her BlackBerry and not digging in properly. And that was her failure.
But I don't think that's the way the BBC see it. I think they actually see it as they have to have people who are running discrete channels now. They can't have this distraction, which makes me wonder whether Radio 1 is going to get a new controller too in that case, an actual dedicated controller, because I think it ought to have one.
I think Radio 1 probably needs a new controller, and if you asked Andy Parfit, he'd probably say he's coming towards the end of his time as controller. Andy Parfit for Radio 2 is perfect. New young guy for Radio 1. New young person for Radio 1.
I don't care who gets the job, so long as they leave Elaine Page and Sounds of the 60s exactly where they are on
and
the weekend.
And you're far too young to be listening to Elaine Page. It's aimed at the over 50s, Stephen, there's not a grey hair on your head.
I'm not an easy demographic, I must say, to pigeonhole. Let's move on.
Interesting question. We should talk more about that later.
I'm a very promiscuous media consumer.
Wow.
Let's stop there, but let's stick with radio because Five Live's got a new morning schedule. It's had a bit of a rejig. And what do you make, Paul, of Nikki Campbell's new 9 a.m. phone-in?
Well, I think Nikki Campbell is terrific. I work with Nikki at Radio 1. He's a very intelligent, very good broadcaster. I mean, he does phone-ins extremely well, I think, because I think he's a good listener. And I think he's very good at putting arguments. It seems to me, though, slightly as though the schedule's been designed around Nikki rather than designed around the audience, by giving him this extra hour in bed starting at 7 and his co-presenter starting at 6, and then Nikki stays on for the phone-in from 9 till 10. That seems to me a little bit odd. Putting a phone in after the breakfast show, not a problem with that as a concept. Of course, you might want to debate in more detail issues arising from the breakfast show. The odd thing is that Nikki Campbell then stays on and hosts it afterwards.
Yeah,
Mackie, do you think that Nikki is a good man for the job?
Yes, I do. And I think he's a great broadcaster and he's aggressive. I mean, if you've ever been interviewed by him, it's like being punched. I mean, he really comes for you.
But he's intelligent, you know.
I know he's very good. And I think he's a fantastic television presenter.
I agree.
As a consumer watchdog presenter, he's got it. I mean, he's really that show. And so, yeah, I think I love phone-ins. And
BBC don't really do that well, though, do they?
My big grouse
you
about
and yours
the BBC.
Is,
it's pathetic. Yep. My big grouse about the BBC is that because they do phone-ins on 5, they don't let Radio 4 do phone-ins. And I think it's a disgrace because the Radio 4 audience is so intelligent and so often well-informed. When they do
happen... Like you, Maggie.
No. When they do happen, for example, they have one over the collapse of the banks. You find a former chief executive of a bank ringing in.
Yeah.
You know, it's just fantastic.
But my theory about Radio 4 phone-ins is this. They overproduce them. They overfilter the callers. The great thing about Radio 5 Live is you get the unexpected. They put somebody on the air, you don't know what they're going to say, and there's that moment of magic where they actually say something controversial, which is a spark that prompts something else. At Radio 4, it's all produced out. All the spontaneity is produced out.
Well, look, there's been a bunch of other stories this week from the print world. Let's start with News of the World and its big Prince Harry exclusive. Now, we actually got some web figures in about the story about Prince Harry's controversial video. They had record comments on their blogs, and on the Sunday, 400,000 people in the UK went onto the website to watch the video. So the News of the World are cock-a-hoop. They're saying that this is a modern newspaper story because you've got print elements and online, so that your traditional newspaper reader will go on the site to have a look. And then the younger reader of the YouTube generation, who don't really care for print, will still be on the News of the World site looking at the video. So is this the way of the future, Paul?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think what's extraordinary is how the royal family are still a news story that actually engage everybody. You know, as you say, young and old are interested in what Prince Harry said. I think the story is a little bit neither here nor there, rather. But the point is, you know, the engagement, I think, is amazing.
Maggie, do you think that we're going to be seeing video on every website page on newspapers? Because that's very much the News of the World policy.
Well, if it works, I mean, they're desperate, aren't they? Their sales are going down. They need some new shot in the arm. It's like a sort of, you know, an exciting, sudden discovery that they can do it and they can have such a big impact. Yeah, I mean, of course, that will be the new thing to get. We all know this effect. Everybody goes for the same kind of thing. Actually, I didn't rate it, though, to be honest with you.
Okay, moving on. More bad news. The Financial Times is cutting 80 jobs, 13 going at The Economist. Price rises at The Guardian, The Observer, The News of the World and The Sunday Mirror. It's still very grim out there, Maggie.
It's extremely grim, but I would say that these are, if you like, minor cuts. I mean, the FT's cuts are, what, 4% of their journalistic staff. Putting up the cost of newspapers, well, that's inevitable, because the old equation for broadsheets, advertising and cover price were roughly supposed to be 60-40. Now, obviously, things have changed. So anything that this is about surviving at the moment. I mean, we talked about the Standard's plight, which is unbelievable, given it's had a paid-for monopoly. We are in a really, really serious situation where we don't know what else we're going to lose. We've talked sort of loosely about titles being closed or bought or whatever. Now, suddenly, you know, this is happening. One of the things I found out this week, which has really saddened me, is the Commonwealth Press Union, which I know is a small body, but it's a historic body that's been going for 100 years. It suddenly closed down at the end of December.
And no one noticed.
And it was mainly because the newspaper industry here could not afford the subscriptions anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the first big newspaper organisation I can think of which trained journalists just going like that.
Well, Paul, the Daily Telegraph thinks it's found a parcel solution. It's outsourcing its subbing processes on the weekend to Australia, of all places.
Yeah, shocking. It's worse than Indian call centres, isn't it?
Next, they're going to be letting Australians write stories on Fleet Street newspapers, Maggie.
But, Stephen, you could stay in Australia, all that sun, and you could just work over there.
That's a very tempting thought. Thank you very much. Excellent. Well, you'll find links to all these stories and more at mediaguardian.co.uk. Next week, Ofcom will deliver its finalised list of recommendations to the government about the future of public service broadcasting. That looming deadline has created a mad rush of TV bigwigs eager to push their own agendas. We've had BBC Director General Mark Thompson saying he supports a merger between Channels 4 and 5, only for Channel 4's Andy Duncan to dismiss such a merger as, quote, making no sense whatsoever. ITV Executive Chairman Michael Grade weighed in too, saying that his channel had to be freed from many of its public service broadcasting obligations, like regional news. Maggie, let me come to you first. This seems a bit of a mad scramble for government cash at the moment, but is it like bald men fighting over a comb?
Well, I've actually felt entirely differently. I felt rather like a debutante in some sort of season where you see the same people all the time and they're all trying to push an agenda and you're in different venues and it's sort of breakfast this morning, it was, you know, lunch, you name it. Everybody's trying to sort of put their point of view. And it's all so self-interested. It's broadcasters really just trying to influence the government their way. And you come out of these events like this morning and you think, oh, for goodness sake, please, let's think about what the public wants, what society wants, what Britain wants, not just what you rather selfish and overpaid people are trying to push in order to protect your empires.
Well, Mark Thompson, he was in the FT this week with pushing the...
The 4-5 merger, which is a completely old idea. Look, I'm the historian of Channel 4. I had a whole chapter on why this was a bad idea.
But in fact, Duncan said, "Ofcom going to say?"
Well, I think Ofcom were very iffy about it when it was first put to them. Remember, Stephen Carter was there at the time. The big problem is it's oil and water. Channel 4 is a public-owned broadcaster. It doesn't exist to pay dividends or service anybody else.
And 5 is the opposite.
5 is a commercial broadcaster. 5 is actually the weakest of the broadcasters. Channel 4, in a sense, would be a fantastic catch for RTL. But why on earth should it be privatised or its status changed, which would again weaken it? It would be even less of a public service broadcaster. I think it's a really, really bad idea.
In fact, Paul, we had a blog post on one of our stories this week saying that a merger of Channel 5 and 4 would be like merging Sainsbury's with Aldi. Is that how it is for you, do you think?
Oh, far worse. I mean, I think Maggie's right. I mean, if you really want to have public service broadcasting provided by other than the BBC, then merging 5 and 4 is going to reduce the chance of that merged entity providing public service broadcasting. It's totally chalk and cheese. And, you know, if the issue here is, can advertising fund public service broadcasting? That's what's driving this. You know, the issue is that going forward, there is a real dichotomy. You know, know, between getting a big audience and doing public service broadcasting and thereby attracting advertising revenue. If you merge those two together, it still only represents a third of the television advertising market. You've still got ITV, you know, with over half. So it's not going to fundamentally improve their ability to drive advertising revenues with the merged entities. So I see no benefit at all. I see disbenefit, and I think it's a crazy idea. Of course, Mark Thompson supports it.
But well, he's other actually thing trying to disturb the, you know, just throw dust into people's eyes, because
exactly.
He doesn't want Channel 4 to get any kind of traction on BBC Worldwide, which is, of course, the favoured option. And that's what Channel 4 wants. It wants some form of assistance from BBC Worldwide, some really cash benefit.
Well, in fact, you've written about this before, and I know this because I actually put your blog up onto the website, and you question whether giving Channel 4 a chunk of the BBC Worldwide action meant that Ofcom had gone bonkers. Well, do you still feel that way?
What I said then was that to give it to Channel 4 with no cost to Channel 4, just transfer it, was like a Vladimir Putin move, that it was actually just transferring a state-owned asset almost randomly over to a more deserving, in your opinion, cause. And I thought that was entirely wrong, and it wouldn't work, and it would destroy the value in Worldwide. Where I have changed my views somewhat is that if we could find a way of Channel 4 buying into Worldwide, contributing sweat equity as well afterwards with the programmes it commissions, with the rights it then owns, that's a somewhat different kettle of fish, because it isn't going bust. It does have £20 million, £200 million in the bank. It also has a freehold building worth about £50 million. And these are real assets that could perhaps be swapped in some way for revenue streams.
Well, next week we should be a whole lot clearer on all these issues. Which way do you think Ofcom is going to go?
Well, I think Ofcom is definitely committed to saying that the system needs more money. What it can't do is deliver the system. What I also went to this week was Colette Beau, the new chairman of Ofcom's grilling before the two parliamentary committees, business and culture, media, sport. And she made it clear that she was totally dedicated to protecting children's television in this country. Now, to do that, it actually implies that you're going to put some money up.
Paul, you've said previously, on a previous podcast here, in fact, that you don't see the point of having a competitive, pluralist public service broadcasting model. Do you still feel that way? And if so, which way do you think Ofcom should leap next week?
I think it's going to be very, very hard to support public service broadcasting other than via the public purse.
Yes.
And we think the licence fee is currently the best way of doing it. And I think that's probably right. So then the question is, from the licence fee, how many people actually have a share of the licence fee? Is it the BBC and one other, or is it just the BBC? And I think the risk of splitting the licence fee up will merely take a lot of money up in managing that process rather than getting the BBC honest and making great programming. I think a really good BBC, properly funded but not overfunded, making great programming the market doesn't provide, is the best way forward.
The Guardian's TV writer and previewer Gareth McLean's joined us for the final segment of the show. Well, it must have been a tough week for you, Gareth.
Yes.
Carol's no longer on Countdown. Trish has been cancelled on Five. And then the Finder's crispy pancakes have gone out of business. That's your afternoon ruined.
It really is. I tell you, it's. I mean, you know, I should phone the Samaritans, really. Shouldn't I? How am I going to cope with it?
Well,
I tell you, though, I'm quite pleased about that oligarch. Have you been talking about him already?
Yes, just a little bit.
I mean, all that money. And did you see his outfit? Those white shoes and those terrible jeans. Yes!
Yeah, look.
He's standing like man from CNA on the front of today's paper.
He wears suits and sneakers. That's his thing. He's modern and progressive.
Having said that, I am available for work if Jordy Gregg says no.
Anyway, Countdown. It's back. It's been revamped. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Oh, I think thumbs wobbling about in the middle. Well, it's all right, isn't it? Isn't it for pensioners and students and other people who smell of wee?
Let's get a slightly more serious take
yes,
on the
sorry.
New presenters,
Jeff
please.
Sterling.
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. I sort of said watching him's like, he's so cheesy. It's like being hosed down with Dairy Lee.
I did, and I read that and I laughed, but then I thought Gareth Countdown is cheesy. It's what it's there for.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. I thought she was fine, Rachel Riley. Credit,
well, I thought
credit crunch
fine.
Carol Vorderman.
I thought they were both fine. Paul, You actually know Jeff Stelling, don't you?
I do.
You can still be objective, can't you?
Of course, because he might be listening. I started in radio with Jeff in 1979, and he was a presenter on a station called Radio Tees, along with people like Helen Bowden and other notables, Mark Mardell, who were on there. And he did the sports show, which was called Tees Sport, very clever name. But the thing about him is, obviously, doing a sports show, you've got to listen to all the different reports coming in, and Jeff had very Buffon hair in those days, and he would never wear his headphones. So he kept on missing all these reports coming in because he couldn't hear them.
Gosh.
Tees. Nice guy.
Tees Radio, was that?
Radio Tees.
Maggie,
just
moving
ripe
on.
For actually, innuendo, isn't it?
Two S's.
We're moving on.
Oh, I see.
Maggie, you watched Countdown. Do you think that the new hosts made any difference to the programme at all?
Well, it seemed slower to me. I liked Jeff, though, because I thought he was really competent, and Des O'Connor seemed a bit out of it. He just used to smile.
Very orange.
I thought Rachel was very, very pretty. In fact, I sat on the
very,
train.
Very, very pretty. Thank God she's got a maths degree.
I know. I sat on the train after it. I was going into London, and I heard this guy say behind me, well, Countdown, you know, she's very pretty, but she can't do the sum. She got them wrong. And that sort of, I think, summed up the general kind of view for me.
Tell you what I thought. Andrew Saxon, Dictionary Corner. Doesn't he look frail?
He does look frail, yes.
Exactly. He's quite old, isn't he?
Yeah.
He is. He's
70-something.
I was worried that he was going to actually fluff his lines. I was sitting there at home thinking, oh,
I know nothing.
Right. But he did fine. But he went on for quite a long time.
I'm from Boston anyway.
Back onto me. Gareth,
that was at least 2 minutes when you weren't talking.
Exactly.
Steven. God, are you
all right? No, because I want to tell you, on Monday, I, having read your TV preview, swept out of the gym early and raced home so I could get in front of ITV 1 at 9 p.m. for Unforgiven.
Yeah, well, there's a sentence you don't say very often. Yeah, I rushed home to get in front of ITV 1.
No, but it was a fantastic programme.
Absolutely
now,
brilliant.
Everyone's looking a bit puzzled, so tell us about it, Gareth.
Unforgiven is a Sally Wainwright drama from Red Productions, who've obviously got a big pedigree in making quality things. Suran Jones stars as Ruth Slater, a woman who's been released from prison after 15 years for killing two policemen, and it's all about the repercussions of that. So it's really good, wonderfully atmospheric. David Evans.
In Coronation Street. And she was brilliant. I totally believed her. But part of the attraction of the programme for me was that I couldn't quite work out what was going on. Was it a murder mystery? Was it a thriller? And then is there some kind of supernatural element in there or not? And there's two more weeks to go, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a three-parter. I like that about it too. We weren't spoon-fed as the audience. You know, usually you're sort of battered over the head with these things, and it's like, this is what's happening now. But there was none of that. It was a really kind of nice sort of. It treated you like a grown-up, and I really thought that. And it was directed by David Evans, who did The Children, Lucy Gannon's thing, which was also good, apart from that last part when it went a bit wrong.
I missed that bit. Anyway. Paul, have you caught up with the new BBC Three schedule? They're having a talent contest for butchers that everyone's labelled Chop Idol. Is this one of Danny Cohen's new crazy ideas?
Not seen it, no idea. Gareth?
Well, should we not get started on BBC Three?
I think that doesn't it have great success with things like Kill, Cook and Eat? So maybe this is a sort of, you know, version of that. You know, get your own food, organise yourself, lads. Because it's a sort of blokey.
It's rubbish, isn't it?
Kind of idea,
I mean, it's just
really.
Nonsense, isn't it?
Actually, there's one thing I did want to bring up.
But it's multi-platform nonsense.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay, so that's fine. That's fine then. Oh, well, big take.
BBC Three is going to have a day of reckoning because the BBC Trust are going to be looking hard at it, whether it's actually performing its duty in appealing to younger audiences. It's perfectly possible that it will not stay in the current format that it's in. It may, for example, start earlier.
Stephen
Cast
put that into his public service broadcasting review.
Okay, well, thank you, one and all. That's it for my time in front of the big microphone.
Well, wait. We need to mention the return of Battlestar Galactica on Tuesday.
Oh, do we?
That's beyond exciting.
That is beyond exciting.
We'll identify the final Cylon.
Right, on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Maggie Brown.
Well, that's it for my time in front of the microphone. What a treat it's been. So to share your thoughts on anything other than my presenting skills, post a comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or head to the Facebook group. Matt Wells will be back next week with a special podcast live-ish from the Oxford Media Convention. For now, please thank our guests, Gareth McLean, Paul Robinson and Maggie Brown. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green and I'm Stephen Brookovich. So goodbye, or as they say in Moscow, spaziba.
Spaziba?
Yeah.
Spaziba.
Yeah. Spaziba.